from listener-supported KTOO. Welcome to a special episode of Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Tuesday, May 13th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Thank you for joining the conversation. Today, it's a curious Juno takeover here on Juno Afternoon. I've got KTOO's digital content director, Adeline Baxter, in the studio with me today. Curious Juno is a series from KTOO that looks into and examines questions from listeners like you that you've wondered about, can't figure out, or have heard rumors about. We look back at some of the early episodes as well as some listener favorites. And we look ahead to what's in store as KTOO kicks off another season of Curious Juno this Thursday and Friday with new episodes and a meet and greet. It's a deep dive into Curious Juno today on Juno Afternoon. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Hanson Gress. Ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakaya ha anikak gunish cheesh.
Erin Heiss moved to Juneau with her family when she was 9. Now the state admin officer is hoping for some insight into a rumor that never quite lost its appeal.
I vaguely remember at some point hearing that a gorilla ran for mayor in Juneau and promised everyone bananas. That was like his big campaign promise. And I just want to know if that happened.
Heiss says she first thinks she heard the rumors in high school. About 1999 or 2000, she says. KTOO's Matt Miller sat down with Heiss to try to get to the bottom of her rumor.
What would you say if the gorilla was still around?
You mean like happily retired here in Juneau?
A person wearing a black fur gorilla suit just walked into the room.
No!
For just a few minutes on a normal Friday afternoon, Joe Gorilla, played by Jeff Brown, came out of semi-retirement. He decided to pop into the studio for an appearance.
What?
Hey, how's it going, Aaron?
Oh my God! Of course! Of course it's you!
Heiss first met Brown in 2000 when she started volunteering for KTOO during her senior year of high school. More recently, the two have worked together for the Alaska Folk Festival, but she had no idea he was the gorilla. In 1985, the Master of Merriment, Brown, ran a write-in campaign for Juno Mayor as Joe Gorilla.
Is this the actual gorilla outfit?
Yes.
Did you promise bananas for everyone?
Banana daiquiris.
That's even better.
According to an Associated Press story published in the Sitka Daily Sentinel, in October of 1985, Joe Gorilla lost. Ernie Pauley won that year with 4,482 votes.
And how'd you come up with the platform?
It just came naturally to me. It's a jungle out there, man.
The best political platform in the bunch.
I can't wait to tell my husband. It's all real. I didn't make it up. This is great.
That's it for this Curious Juno. I'm Trip J. Krause. For the full podcast or to ask your own question, go to ktoo.org/curious.
You like bananas?
I like bananas, yeah. I like banana pancakes. I like bananas faster. Who doesn't like bananas?
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. That, what you just heard, was the very first Curious Juno that ever aired. It was back in February of 2017. I'm joined now in the studio by KTOO's Digital Content Director, new title for Adeline Baxter. How are you? Wasa iti. Gunath Cheesh for being here today, Adeline.
Great. Gunath Cheesh. Thank you, Boston.
So let's start with the history, because we played the very first episode. This is a Curious Juno takeover of Juno Afternoon. We're previewing and listening back to some old episodes, as well as looking ahead to what's coming up this next season. But the beginning of it, how did it start all the way back in 2017?
Yeah, well, it's funny because it started in February 2017, 6 months before I arrived in Juno. And so I had to go check in with some alumni, you know, Jeremy Shea, about what the origins were. And it just seems like there was sort of some inspiration at the time around some similar series that were happening in other cities and stuff. And there was also just clearly, like, listeners were asking a lot of questions and they wanted to create a platform and a regular series where they could answer, the newsroom could answer these questions. And so Trip Krause, as you just heard, was really instrumental in that. Matt Miller and Jeremy getting it off the ground. And when I arrived in August, it was already well underway. And I just remember being like, you know, just sitting in the newsroom as a brand new, fresh off the ferry person and asking like, well, what's the deal with this? What's the deal with the eye up on the mountain there? And they'd be like, oh, well, here's an episode. And, you know, what are these weird reflector things up on top of Mount Juno? And there was already an episode about that. So it's this great local resource. And there have also been so many others over the years that answer questions I never had, like, why aren't there strip clubs in Juno? Never thought to ask that one, but somebody did. And yeah, there's a very interesting backstory about it.
So I know they mentioned in that piece there, and that one was the original first one was called Where Does a Gorilla Run for Mayor? Mm-hmm. Juno, of course. Most of the Curious Juno titles start with a question because it's usually a query, like you said, from a listener. And there is a website. You can go to kto.org/curiousjuno. I think they said /curious, which probably still works.
Yep.
But Curious Juno, you can search that and you can see all the episodes on there. There's also a podcast that people can subscribe to. Is this also where, let's say I'm listening now and I have a question, is this where I go to submit my question as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. You can do it right there on that page. I mean, there are lots of different ways you can reach the newsroom, and people obviously send us questions about, like, very specific and sometimes much more, like, timely things mm-hmm. all the time to just, like, the general news email. But this is a particular place for people to send sort of their historical or quirky or, you know, this just popped into my brain, and you guys don't have to rush on it, but I've been wondering, and maybe you guys know.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, because, I mean, Juno does have a lot of curiosities. We're going to play some fun episodes about that. But let's talk about, real quick, the new season. Sounds like we're going to post the first episode of this season on Friday.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And that's also, you're going to be doing a special event. Tell
us
about
that. Yes, we are going to do another one of our Coffee with K2 events. We've done a few of those, and it's just an excuse to bring people into the station early in the morning, get some snacks, get some breakfast and coffee, and chat about things going on in the newsroom and also other departments as well. But this week, we wanted to make it more themed around Curious Juno since we're launching the new season. So we'll have the premiere of this episode. And then we also want to ask folks to vote on what other questions. We get a lot of Curious Juno submissions, like all throughout the year. They kind of trickle in. Every now and then they kind of surge in. Something like certain stories seem to make people think about their questions.
Mm.
And so we've got like a backlog at this point, and we can't answer them all, unfortunately, because these do take a while to report and research. But we figured people on Friday morning could help us decide what to end the season with. We already have a few other stories, a few other questions in the works, but there's plenty more for people to, submit in the meantime, but also just to help us kind of whittle down.
Okay. And what's the when and where for this event on Friday morning?
So this is Friday starting at 8, but we'll go probably till like 9:30-ish. So you can come
in the morning,
whenever.
Right?
Yes, in the morning before work. And it's just downstairs in the studio, 1A. And we'll, like I said, just sort of be casual and chatting and drinking coffee. But then we'll do the premiere of this first episode, which is an episode by Yvonne, Krumri, and then we will have people vote on what we should end the season on.
Cool. Yeah, we'll have some little bits of clips, teaser for Yvonne's episode here in just a little bit. But I want to play another episode now. It's the question that people ask a lot, and it's already been answered by Curious Juno, and you can find it in the record. So I'm sure it's really easy to go and find this. And of course, on today's webpage for this episode, I'll list links to all these things that you're hearing today, so you can find them all in one spot as well. But Juno's concrete blocks spark tall tales about their origins. Everyone has questions about those concrete blocks, and here's the Curious Juno to answer it.
Tall tales abound about the mysterious blocks near Lemon Creek. Ancient monoliths, hatches for alien spacecraft, white Alice, even cow graves. But nothing really, so to speak, concrete. I'm Trip Krause with KTOO, and in this Curious Juno, we look into one of our most frequently asked questions. What are those blocks along Vanderbilt Hill Road? Mert Calvert was one of the first to ask. We took a walk around the wetlands.
Nice, cold, clear day out here. Sun kind of shining through, but shining through enough. We're out in the wetlands right at the turnoff off of Egan, right by the Pioneer Home. And all of these concrete pilings and traffic going by. And
some blocks sport rebar handles to climb up. On one, three pieces of rebar poke out of the top, perhaps a way to anchor a larger insulation.
They're in some type of a pattern out here, and I have zero idea why. So I'm trying to figure out what the pattern is and why they're here instead of somewhere else.
A blog about Alaska's Cold War era early warning radar system led me to a military connection. In 1992, the U.S. Army put together an inventory of debris at the site. Army documents note a 28-by-73-foot building, a 10-by-17-foot building, and 40 concrete antenna footings. Our blocks. I called the cartographer for the city and borough of Juneau. He found an aerial photo from 1962. The antennas are already gone, but the footprints of the blocks are clear. It's another piece of the puzzle. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had more. The Corps documented that the Army originally obtained the site by special use permit from the Department of Interior in July 1954. Richard Regal is a project manager at the Alaska District of Army Corps of Engineers. He works in a program that focuses on cleaning up formerly used Department of Defense sites.
Most of these sites were used briefly by DOD and then turned over to other federal or private entities. This is one of the early projects that the Alaska District worked on.
Regal says the Corps hired a contractor to perform a site assessment in 1985. That included digging into some historical records about the site. A 1986 report prepared for the Army identified the site as the Juneau, Alaska Communication System 5-Mile Station. It includes a brief military history that says it was used as a Juneau Kenai VHF scatter circuit project and storage site. Corps documents show the U.S. Coast Guard and Bureau of Land Management took possession in 1959. This is where the Corps' paper trail went cold. Former Juneau resident Kathleen Teeny Metcalf was born in the mid-1950s and remembers asking her dad about the blocks.
He said that they were the bases for communication towers. I don't remember towers being on them, even when I was a kid. I just remember the concrete blocks.
In the mid-1970s, she remembers cleaning a telecommunications building in that area.
It was a little tiny building, and it was somewhere near where the Pioneer Home is now. For whatever reason in my mind, the Coast Guard ran it. I remember when you went inside, there was just a bunch of, you know, like radios, but they were built into the walls.
Metcalf says there was also a telephone operator's headset and a switchboard. That fits with the 1986 Corps report. Regal says
the Coast Guard was using the buildings on the site and had no concerns about anything, and if I remember correctly, the state wasn't interested in the former antenna anchors being cleaned up that were in the wetland.
Army documents say that removing the footings would be more harmful than letting them stay.
You'd have to take a fairly big excavator into the wetland, which would be fairly destructive.
Today, online property records show the Alaska Department of Natural Resources owns a property on the north side of Vanderbilt Hill Road, about 26 acres. The U.S. Coast Guard owns 5 acres on the other side. The blocks are still there to this day, but that doesn't keep people like Mark Calvert from guessing what they are.
You know, you never know in this town why somebody does something, and so you see the aftermath of a lot of crazy ideas around town sometimes.
In Juneau, I'm Trip J. Kraus. For more Curious Juneau stories, or to submit your own question, go to ktoo.org/curious. And if you have photos of Five Mile Station, email us at curious@ktoo.org.
You're listening to Juneau Afternoon on a special Tuesday episode talking about Curious Juneau. I'm here with KTOO's digital content director, Adeline Baxter. Now, Adeline, what we just heard was about those concrete blocks that everybody sees and their origins. Now, you were talking about, you know, the idea of reporting on these stories, and sometimes it can take a little long. And how long did it take Trip to work on that story?
Yeah, I mean, Trip Kraus, I probably should have called them up before this, but I seem to recall at the time, because I was here when Trip put that story out, that it involved like a public records request and really digging into some archives and going back in the history. And a lot of the stories do. So in that case, I'm pretty sure it took Trip close to a year.
Wow.
Please, yeah, Trip, text me if that's wrong. But that's what I remember at the time. And I remember being very intimidated when I went to do my first Curious Juneau, because I was like, wait, that took Trip a really long time. But
right,
they're not all like that. But if you look back in the archives, Trip did a lot of really deeply researched ones, Matt Miller as well, a lot of history and stuff. And so, yeah, they can be quite an investment.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that. Now, I want to ask you about this right here, which is the thing we hear every time a Curious Juneau episode starts. This is that lovely little sound. What is that song and where did it come from? That's my Curious Juneau question.
That's a good question. Yeah. It's called Uneven Spiral, and it's by a composer named Simon Mathewson. And as far as I understand it, somebody in the newsroom stumbled upon it, and Simon very generously allowed us to use the music for free for this series. And he just composes music and offers it out to folks if they're using it for a non-commercial purpose to use for free. He lives in Berlin now, and I believe he's American, though, but he has a lot of really interesting music on his website, so I definitely encourage people to check him out.
Yeah, what's his name again?
Simon Mathewson.
Simon Mathewson.
Mathewson, yeah.
Mathewson, okay. Mm-hmm. It's a cool song, oftentimes we don't get to hear the whole thing.
Right.
But you get to hear like pieces of it, like in that piece about the blocks. I know that at the end of it, mm-hmm, that Trip started to play a little bit of the funky stuff at the end of that song.
Yeah.
Like we're just hearing now, which is kind of cool. So
I love it. It's such a good, like, curious sounding song.
Yeah, it's very fun. Okay, and then the other thing I wanted to ask you about was the logo.
Yeah, we have this really nice logo that Pat Race actually designed, and it's on the main Curious Juneau page. It also shows up on the stories whenever we publish them, but just this really cool, like, question mark with a little bit of a kind of Juneau background behind it, and it just is like the perfect little logo for the series.
That's awesome. Now, I do want to tease with maybe one little clip before we get into some favorite episodes. The first Curious Juneau that's going to be happening for 2025. And this is a long-standing question. It's been one that's been outstanding for a long time, and it's one that a lot of people want to know, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it has a title yet, but can you tell us what this one's going to be about?
Yeah, that's a good. I think we're still settling on the headline, but basically it's, what are the origins of the North Douglas chocolate cake, which is something, yeah, I have also wondered. I'm like ashamed to admit, as a person who was in Juneau for a long time, like I have not tried a North Douglas chocolate cake. I know my landlord had one every year on his birthday, and I know that's true for a lot of folks in Juneau, that it's got this very sentimental place, but Most people, I think, do know that it comes from the Fiddlehead Cookbook, which the Fiddlehead restaurant was in Juneau, was in a Juneau establishment for a very long time. And even though the restaurant closed, many of the recipes, and especially North Douglas chocolate cake, have this resounding place in
the lore of Juneau.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So here's the question. Are we having North Douglas chocolate cake at this special event on Friday at 8?
Spoiler alert. God, Boston, you ruined the surprise.
Well, we got to have
it. And also, you're setting the expectations for my baking skills so high. I'm kind of stressed about it because I am not a baker. But
I think you're going to be just fine. Here's a little just quick soundbite from Yvonne Crumry's episode about North Douglas chocolate cake.
And my boss at the time said, "Well, what's the name?" And I said, "Choco Bake." And he goes, "No." He goes, "You're the North Douglas Baker. Let's call it the North Douglas Chocolate Cake." And I think that's half of it. It has a cool name.
It does have a cool name. That's very cool. And I think this will end up being one of those episodes that rivals some of the most popular. And we're going to play a couple of those now. I think probably this first one we're going to play may be the most can I guess that? Is it the most popular episode ever?
I mean, it's hard to gauge that kind of thing. We could go off web views, streams on the podcast. I know at the time when it came out, it had the most comments I'd ever seen on any KTOO story because everybody has memories associated, many people bitter memories, and it's just been sort of a sore spot for Juneau for a long time.
Yeah, and here it is. What happened to Juneau's Taco Bell?
In the late 90s, Juneau had two Taco Bells, but by the early 2000s, they were both gone. When I asked the Juneau Community Collective Facebook group for leads on what happened, I got more than 160 comments, ranging from "employees were selling drugs" to "wasn't it hepatitis?" Clearly, people have a lot of ideas about what led to the restaurant's demise, but former employee Jennifer Solano says most of them aren't true.
You know, every business, they're going to have drama and rumors and this and that. But to be honest, Taco Bell was a good, wholesome place to work. And they taught me enough that I've been able to raise a family, continuing my career managing fast food restaurants.
Solano runs a Subway in Anchorage now, but she started working for Taco Bell in Juneau as a teenager. In the mid-90s, it sat where the Asiana Garden restaurant is now, across from Super Bear.
We were having repeated problems with our freight coming in with the shipments. We would have to throw away sour cream, cheeses, lettuce, tomatoes. They were coming in continuously frozen when they were only supposed to be refrigerated, and we were having to waste a lot of money.
Solano eventually became an assistant manager. She says getting quality produce from the lower 48 was just one of many problems.
Everything in the building was just kind of crumbling and falling apart. There were so many times that the grease trap had to be redone because the pipes underneath all the flooring were so old and brittle that they were actually collapsing.
Plumbers were called in to try to fix the issue at night, which meant workers the next morning were walking on temporary floorboards.
Because it's not an overnight project. So then we tried to keep staffing at minimal so that nobody was running into each other or getting hurt.
Eventually, it became a cycle. A pipe would be fixed, the flooring would go back in, and another pipe would collapse. The Valley Taco Bell also went through several different managers. Solano says she often picked up the slack when one of them was attending meetings in Anchorage. And at one point, someone at corporate decided to add a Baskin-Robbins ice cream counter to the mix.
They would expect, you know, somebody that's making burritos to go over and make a frappuccino. You know, you got to make cakes out of ice cream and you got to be able to decorate them. And, you know, trying to run a Taco Bell side and trying to make cakes was pretty rough for me.
Repairs became so expensive that the owners started looking for a new building to move to.
But there was no good place in Juneau at the time, you know, 18, 20 years ago, to put a fast food restaurant with a drive-through in it. So they decided that they were going to cut their losses and just go ahead and close the doors.
Some workers didn't even have advance notice that the restaurant was closing. They showed up the next day to a note on the door and were told to pick up their compensation checks. The Valley location was the last Taco Bell to exist in Juneau, but at one point, the city had two Taco Bells. There was a smaller express restaurant downtown. It shared a space with Subway in a building where Sea Alaska Heritage now sits. Charles McHenry started there in 1987 and worked his way up to general manager.
Taco Bell was doing a competition called the Golden Bell. They had started it, and we managed to take that store to number 7 in the nation for quality and service out of 1,500 franchise stores.
But the downtown restaurant wasn't very profitable. It closed in the summer of 1999 when the corporate office decided to focus its efforts on the Valley location. McHenry was transferred there as a shift manager to try to improve the service.
The gentleman running the store insisted that no one listen to me because it was his store and he would teach them his way, not necessarily the Taco Bell way. Didn't care about quality or service. It was all about his bottom line, even if it meant not being honest about some of the numbers.
Eventually, McHenry quit because of that manager, but he says his experience wasn't all bad.
I loved working in this community. We had great people. It was a fantastic product. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed working for Taco Bell itself, but it could only take so much.
Now, if you're like me and still craving a Crunchwrap Supreme, your best bet is served at the Lemon Creek Breeze Inn. In Juneau, I'm Bridget Dowd.
And you're listening to Juno Afternoon from KTOO on a Tuesday afternoon. It's the Curious Juno Takeover. That was the episode, What Happened to Juno's Taco Bell? And I didn't realize there were actually two Taco Bells, which is kind of cool. And then Adeline, a few years later, Clarice did another follow-up, kind of a follow-up to it, called What Happened to the Fast Food Restaurants That Used to Be in Juno? And why aren't there more today? And that goes into sort of really interesting detail because it talks about the cost of being a franchise and
yeah, it gets way more into the economics.
Yeah, the economics part of it. So you can catch all those episodes on kto.org/curiousjuno. A lot of these episodes are in the four columns that you'll see when you'll pull that website up. You can also submit your own questions to Curious Juno if you have something that you are wondering about, if you're curious about, or that you've heard rumor about. You can submit that question there. Season, however many seasons there's been, the new season, the 2025 season, will kick off this Friday with a little episode about the North Douglas chocolate cake. I'm going to play one more quick teaser from that. This one's only like, well, I shouldn't ruin it really, but it's really just like a second and a half.
People love this cake.
People love this cake.
People do
they
love
do.
That cake.
They do
yeah.
love that mm-hmm. cake. And I'm can't wait to hear that episode. So that new season kicks off this Friday, and there's an event that's happening downstairs here at KTOO on Friday. That is at 8 a.m.
Yep.
Right?
8 a.m. Bright and early. Yep. Start your day with us. Coffee with K2, but Curious Juno also help us choose our final episode of the season will be.
Absolutely. So that'll be something that you can do. We're listening now to some of the favorite episodes. That last one, Taco Bell, was done by Bridget Dowd, who was here during the pandemic years and really dived into that story, which was really fun. It was very popular. Another big question that we get, and I'm going to play this episode now, Adeline, is about the fact that we even have this in Juno is sort of a thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like that we even have one of these here. But people get, I think we get this question as Junoites a lot.
Or just questions about it. Just not always this one, but something about like, yeah.
Yeah, about this. And one of them is, why don't they have pizza?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think people know what we're talking about now. Does Juno have the world's smallest Costco?
The other day, Phil Fleming was loading up a car in the parking lot of the Costco in Juneau. He said a salty version of something you may have heard before.
Just now on the phone, actually, a woman was saying, yeah, that's the smallest damn Costco I've ever seen. She's comparing it to the Seattle and Anchorage ones. It's one of the smallest, from what I've heard. I'm not a Costco.
But is it the smallest Costco?
In the world?
I'm Jeremy Shea, and this is Curious Juneau.
As far as I can tell, that is true. Yes, Kevin Green, Assistant Vice President, Northwest Regional Operations, Costco Wholesale.
Green says that's out of 770 Costco locations on four continents.
Are there other ones that are close that leave you some doubt?
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
That's it for this Curious Juno. Have your own Curious Juno question? That's my editor, Jennifer Pemberton.
I like the idea of there being a fake ending to it, and then I would want it to continue.
But wait, there is more. Green says the Juno Costco, built in 1993, was a prototype, one of only a few that small.
We built one in Juno, and we built one in Squim, Washington also.
The full-size Costco eventually replaced the one in Squim.
And yeah, at the time, it was a test to see if that kind of smaller market format would work. We've since decided that it probably doesn't, but it does work in Juno.
Juno's Costco is about half the size of a typical store, which is around 160,000 square feet, like the one that opened in Fairbanks in November.
3, 2, 1.
And it's only a third the size of the world's biggest in Salt Lake City, Utah. That was also a test build. It opened in 2015. In Juno, Green says the geography limits growth and makes shipping challenging, but it is a profitable store with 2 to 3% growth per year and 100-plus employees. Back in the parking lot, customer Steve Houlihan ventures a guess about why Juno's store can cut it.
But I think because of the villages and all the stuff that comes remotely here, this seems like it's got a lot of use. But it doesn't seem like the parking lot's as full as it is down south. You can't get in and out of them down south. So
there is one patron, about 70 miles away by boat, who's about as transparent as can be about his dependence on Costco.
I am Toshua Parker, founder of Costco, which is, I believe, about 8 years old now.
Toshco, with a T. It's a hardware and grocery store in Gustavus. Parker founded it as Icy Straight Wholesale, but the community promptly rebranded it.
Everyone calls it Toshco. Before the doors opened, people started calling it that because my name's Tosh, and most of the products in the beginning all came from Costco in Juneau.
Parker says Costco's store brand products are pretty ubiquitous in Gustavus, which has a year-round population of about 450. But Caroline Malseed in Juneau thinks she's missing out.
We would like it to be bigger.
Why is that?
More stuff.
Juneau's not actually missing out on that much. Costco's Kevin Green says there's about 3,200 products in Juneau's warehouse. A typical one has about 3,800 products at a time. The company did explore a 12,000-square-foot expansion in 2006, though it never happened. Green says it's still a possibility, but there are no current plans. Shopper Phil Fleming is okay with that.
I can't see. Maybe if I saw a bigger one, then I'd be, oh, yeah, we got to have a bigger one. But right now, I'm pretty gruntled with it.
Have your own Curious Juno question? Submit it, subscribe to the Curious Juno podcast, and catch up on past curiosities at ktoo.org/curious. In Juno, I'm Jeremy Shea. When you go into a Costco, do you go clockwise or counterclockwise within the store?
I always go counterclockwise, yeah. Now, although there's some, like where we work in Issaquah, if you go into that building, you do go clockwise because that's the way it's laid out. So there are some, yeah.
I don't know about you, Adeline, but I always save the sample aisle for last. So mm-hmm. I don't know how I start in, but I start at the electronics and I go up to the fresh produce area, and then I cross over and go back down. And
I think that's, yeah, the natural progression.
Is that the natural route for most folks?
Yeah. You and I were just saying while that was playing and we were off air that, gosh, the Juno Costco spoils you for any other Costco because it's so much like less intimidating. The crowds aren't nearly as bad as any of the ones down south or like let alone the one in Anchorage. The two in Anchorage. Juno's
and
Costco
the parking.
Is a dream.
There's so much parking at Costco here, which is amazing. I've bought the ones down in the States. It is the lots are so small. Mm-hmm. And you're like, why? I don't know why that is. That's so funny. Those are some of the favorites. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO from Studio 2K, dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson. I'm with Adeline Baxter, KTOO's digital content director. And we are talking about Curious Juno, which kicks off its new season this Friday. For the 2025 season. And there also will be a news event that morning at 8 a.m. You can stop by the downstairs studio, maybe have a little nosh, and which I already gave away the surprise. But you can have a little nosh, you can talk to the team, and you can help pick what might be the season closer this year in terms of topics. So that's going to be this Friday. I think that's May 16th, this Friday at 8 a.m., right downstairs here at Studio 1A at KTOO. Now, one thing about Curious Junos that I find fascinating, Adeline, is that they offer the opportunity. Obviously, radio is a sound-rich medium. It offers an opportunity for that in these, that the reporters are able to go out and sort of get some sound and stuff. Is that, am I right about that? Does it offer a little bit more of that? Because some of these questions are, like, so intriguing.
Yeah, you know, like, making a sound-rich story is kind of every radio reporter, journalist's favorite thing. And it takes the most work, of course, to go out and collect the sound and weave it all together. It's very time intensive. But so that's why we really like having the excuse of Curious Juno to set aside some time and really get creative with sound, which Jeremy Shea is, of course, legendary for the weird things that he would do with sound. In that episode, you heard him do a weird moment where he caught his editor, Jennifer Pemberton, thinking that the story abruptly ended. But it didn't.
It didn't.
And he would do lots of fun things like that. He once like mic'd himself going down the what's it called, zip line in Hoonah. And like he was always doing stuff like that. And so we still try to do that. So Curious Juno is a really nice opportunity to get kind of have more fun. A lot of the time we're doing hard news, serious stories, having really difficult conversations. But Curious Juno often allows us to be a bit lighter and a bit more like comical.
And as we do that, as we continue our sort of binge of Curious Juno episodes, here's one that uses sound really well. And this is a question a lot of people had and was answered by Anna Canny in last season's Curious Juno season. This is, where do the Foodland ravens roost? Really good question.
It's a misty afternoon, and I'm headed to meet KTOO listener Mark Wheeler in the parking lot of Foodland downtown.
You want to talk by the ravens?
Yeah, let's
talk
to
them over here.
Oh, nice. Okay. He leads me to a large group of ravens that are perched on a chain-link fence.
Yeah, I live pretty close by. So sometimes I'll go to Foodland, get something to eat, and I'll be, like, walking while I eat it. And they'll, like, literally, like, follow you like a gang of thugs, you know, because they're just counting on you dropping something.
Like many Junoites, Wheeler has had a lot of fun watching the curious corvids that wander around downtown. But he noticed that many of them disappear at sundown. So it got him wondering, where do they go at night?
Where's the roost?
For this installment of Curious Juno, I did some late-night detective work to find out. My first lead came from Bob Armstrong, a naturalist and wildlife photographer who's been working in Juno for more than 60 years. In that time, he's photographed hundreds of ravens. One of his favorite shots from Foodland shows a bird with a bright red cup of Raven's Brew coffee.
So I came into the parking lot and just put some latte in it and just set it about 20 feet away from the car and just sat there and waited.
Within a few minutes, a half dozen birds started pecking at it. Eventually, one took the lid in its beak and lifted the cup to show off an illustration of a raven with its wings outstretched. That's when Armstrong snapped a picture.
But then what surprised me is it opened the lid of the cup, and then it drank the latte that was in there.
Ravens are scavengers, meaning they spend their days looking for something, anything, to eat. Insects, berries, eggs, trash from the landfill, and lattes. But their roosting habits are more mysterious. Despite his decades of observation, Armstrong couldn't tell me where ravens go at bedtime.
It requires some probably tagging and that sort of thing.
Scientists in Fairbanks once used radio transmitter tags to track urban ravens on a 40-mile commute to their roost outside the city. But KTOO doesn't have the budget for radio transmitters, at least not that kind of radio transmitter. So I had to find a more low-tech method. Armstrong did have one idea. He said he thinks he's seen ravens roosting in a couple of trees on Willoughby Avenue.
Because if I go to Bullwinkle's for pizza at night and then walk along that sidewalk there, I hear a lot of ravens talking.
So I went there first, at dusk. I got hungry.
It smells like pizza.
But I didn't see any ravens. Then I remembered another thing Armstrong said. He's noticed a few ravens in parking garages nearby. So I charged into the echoey, dimly lit parking garage across the street. The first sign of ravens was actually something that people had installed to keep them out.
Can you hear that? There are sort of these, those spikes that you see to keep birds from perching.
But then I spotted my next clue while looking up at the concrete railing of the third floor.
That is just smattered in white bird poop. almost the way it would look if a bunch of birds were perched up on the ledge with their butts facing out towards me, just pooping freely.
Then a breakthrough.
Oh!
Nestled in a few U-shaped pipes.
There's a nest!
It was made of big sticks, and it looked to be about a foot across. I think it was empty, but I watched it for 20 minutes as it kept getting darker. No ravens appeared. Even though I'd seen plenty of signs that ravens do indeed hang out in the parking garage, I wasn't satisfied. I wanted to look inside the mind of the raven. For that, I turned to John Marsloff, a retired professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington. He spent his career studying crows, jays, and ravens.
There are kind of two strategies in a raven society.
The first one is for older breeding pairs. These birds mate for life, and mates tend to roost together. They're also fiercely territorial, especially when they're tending to a nest like the one I saw in the parking garage.
The rest of raven world are what we call vagrant non-breeders.
And these ravens are the most low-ranking in the bunch. They aren't tied to a particular spot that they're defending or returning to.
They may aggregate at rich food sources like foodland, but it's not the same birds every day. You know, to say that there's a flock or a group that's the foodland ravens, probably not the case.
So there's probably no such thing as the foodland ravens, just ravens that happen to be at foodland. And that makes sense because mostly they're following food. Marsloff's research has shown that ravens travel thousands of square miles looking for their next meal. They're flexible based on changing seasons or the surprise delicacies that might appear.
If all of a sudden there's a big spill of a bag of dog food at foodland, that word's going to get out because the birds that are there will be very active and other birds will hear or see them and come in, and there's a lot of attraction to the commotion.
Marsloff says these vagrant non-breeders will often use roosting as a way to share information. They meet up and form larger communal roosts with dozens or even hundreds of ravens. And there, when they're settling in to get some sleep, they communicate about food sources or predator threats that they encountered during the day. These roosts are often found in tree stands or cliffs, but in an urban environment, that might change. A parking garage, for instance, is usually close to easy food.
It's also warm, and it's also sheltered from the elements, and maybe even a little bit lighter, so they can see any oncoming potential predator, and it might just be the perfect place.
So I tried that theory again. This time in the parking garage of the downtown library.
Okay, I was really about to give up, but I found them.
On the top level of the garage,
there's one, two, three, one on a light post here.
A bunch of ravens were perched in the eaves.
7, 8, 9, there's sort of a cluster of them in one corner.
13 in total, a superstitious number.
It's a little bit scary, actually. It's just past 10 p.m. at night. And I got a bunch of ravens staring me down. I'm kind of blowing up their spot.
They did not want to be interviewed. Makes sense. I basically broke into their house while they were sleeping. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
That's a fun one, Adeline. This is Juneau Afternoon. We're reminiscing and playing some past episodes of Curious Juneau in advance of the 2025 season kicking off this Friday with the Douglas cake story.
And that was something that a lot of us would do at work. We'd bring in a favorite recipe and we'd make it, and for some reason, this one stuck.
This one did stick, and you'll hear more about it on this Friday when they premiere that episode. There's also a special event happening on Friday morning, May 16th at 8 a.m. downstairs here at Studio 1A with the news team talking about Curious Juneau, and you can help select episodes for the last part of the season. And Adeline Baxter, KTO's digital content director, is here with me. And that was a really fun story. Adeline, because, you know, at the end there you heard Anna up in the rafters counting the ravens, which was really cool. But Curious Juneau also gives the opportunity to explore a little bit more about what's going on in Juneau and in the culture specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It, sometimes once you've been here a while and you're used to it and you're used to the quirks about this town, you just stop thinking about some of these things. And it kind of takes a fresh perspective sometimes, or just digging back through our old questions to realize, oh, yeah, that is like a totally weird, like, where do those ravens go at night? Where are the baby ravens? I don't see them. I'm not going to get into the baby bird thing. But and that also made me miss Anna Canny, left at the end of last year, and that made me miss her. She was such a fun voice to hear on the radio.
Yeah, wonderful reporter. And then Yvonne Krumrey, who has been doing a lot of culture reporting, and this is something that is a conversation in town in terms of what things are named here.
Yeah.
And, you know, exploring the culture of that. So we're going to take a listen now to another episode from last season. And this one is called What Are the Original Thlinkit Names for Juneau's Mountains? This is from Yvonne Krumrey. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon on KTOO.
Anywhere you go in Juneau, there are mountains shooting up all around. Mount Juneau and Mount Roberts loom over downtown. On Douglas, Mount Bradley, better known as Mount Jumbo, notoriously blocks South Douglas from getting much sun. And in the valley, there's Thunder Mountain, supposedly named for avalanches rumbling down its slopes. A listener asked KTOO what the mountain's original Thlinkit names are. For this installment of Curious Juneau, I spoke with Thlinkit educators to find out. Like most of Juneau, Kristen Rankin likes to hike. On some of those hikes, she started wondering what some of her favorite peaks were called before they were named after settlers.
I love to be up on all of the mountains around us, and I think it's really important to know those names, and I want to feel connected with the land and the history.
When she was thinking about that history, she couldn't help but see how names like Mount Juneau have only been around for a short time.
Okay, so we have these names that have been in existence for places for, 150 years tops? And then there have been names that have, for places that these names have been around for thousands of years.
University of Alaska Southeast Thlinkit language professor Hune Lance Twitchell says, from a Thlinkit perspective, the newer names don't make much sense.
Imagine if your grandmother was 98 years old and her name was Nora. And I met her, and I start calling her Sally. And then you say, hey, my grandma's name is actually Nora. And if my response is, I've been calling her Sally for like a week now. And if that's my response to just keep calling her by a different name, then it sounds kind of silly. But from a colonial perspective, people say, it's been called that for like 100 years. And so 100 years compared to 18,000 is not a very significant amount of time.
Twitchell says there are much older names for these mountains. Let's take a tour, starting with Mount Roberts.
Starting a little bit towards Thane, there's a place called Wushkinadeyi. And Wushkinadeyi is trails that are going up together.
Next, Mount Juneau.
Coming over this way, you have Yada Utkashe. And Yada Utkashe, if you're standing kind of right outside these studios and looking up towards the mountains that are just kind of to the left of downtown, that's Yada Utkashe.
You might recognize Yada Utkashe as the name of the high school, which makes sense since it faces the school. That name means beautifully adorned face. And that's just the face of Mount Juneau. The top has a different name.
Then if you look up from the high school, there's a mountain with a bit of a rounded top, and that is Shatlach. And Shatlach is a moldy head.
And in the Mendenhall Valley is Thunder Mountain, or...
And Klaxatungan is the one in between Costco and the valley over there. And so Klaxatungan is hands at rest.
As for the peak on Douglas Island, Mount Bradley or Mount Jumbo?
If you were standing here downtown and you look across, then there's a mountain on the other side on the big island over there, and it's called Sayaik.
Sayaik means spirit helper. It's also a part of the name for the elementary school in Douglas.
As we sort of use these names more, we shouldn't be afraid of making mistakes. And so some people are going to say Sayik as opposed to Sayik. And that's not a big deal.
He says with gentle corrections, the right pronunciations will come with time. If you want to learn, there are classes you can take. Nila Toga Anna Clock is a local Tlingit language teacher. She's Koyukon Athabascan and Iyak, so she learned the language as a visitor on Tlingit land.
Indigenous place names often describe the landscape or how to survive on it, how it can be useful to you, what to watch out for there, whereas colonial place names are often named after a person of power or wealth in a faraway land. Because settlers wanted to honor that person if they funded their trip or whatever.
Clock says the Tlingit language community is full of resources that can help people living in Juneau learn more about the land through the language. She sees it as a vital part of getting to know this place.
Having traditional stories to read and listen to, and then having the language community was a big part for me of understanding and feeling like I belong there, even though I'm not of Tlingit heritage, but I belonged there as a student.
One of Clock's mentors, Marie Olson, an Akwan elder, gave Clock some advice that informed how she thinks of her language journey and her role in the world around her.
And one of the things she told me was, you should always be working to learn to be an Indigenous person of the world.
Twitchell says that for most of these place names, it's not a matter of changing a name to a Tlingit one, but changing it back to what it was called before settlers came.
So when we look at place name restoration, we're not looking at changing things so much as to saying it never should have changed in the first place. We were here, we belong, the land belongs to us, we belong to the land, and this relationship is not something that anyone had a right to remove.
Twitchell said language learners are scrambling to record as many place names as possible. It's a race against time, because the number of elders who hold that knowledge dwindle each year. There are just 7 master speakers now. But he says there's room for new place names, too.
It's a living language, and we can make new names as new things emerge or as we find places where we say, we couldn't document those names in time, but we can make some names based on the knowledge that we have of this area.
He believes in a future where everyone living here won't think twice about saying they're going for a hike up Wushkinak Deye or that their kid goes to school at Kakduguwuhin. In Zontek Ahine, I'm Yvonne Crumery.
You're listening to Community Supported Juneau Afternoon on KTOO 104.3 Juneau, 91.7 Juneau Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. I'm in the studio this afternoon on a special episode, a special Tuesday episode, talking about Curious Juneau. We've been reviewing episodes, listening back to some of the popular favorite episodes, as well as some of the early episodes. You can find all the episodes of Curious Juneau on kto.org/curious or kto.org/curiousjuneau. There is a podcast that you can subscribe to as well. And I am in the studio with KTO's digital content director, Adeline Baxter. And Adeline, we've had so much fun sort of binging some of these episodes, listening back to some of these. They're so cool. That last one about Tlingit names here in Juneau, very cool. Mm-hmm. I love that. I've had Saik Gastineau School on recently a couple times the past few weeks, so that's cool to hear that in there. And yeah, it's just so fun to do that. Mm-hmm. As we look ahead, I know we have sort of the first episode that's going to drop this Friday for 2025. I have one more clip about it too that I want to play. This is about the North Douglas chocolate cake.
It's just the sounds of making the cake. All right. Yeah.
That's making of the cake. Well, we were talking about sound rich features. Yep. We didn't know what that was going to
be.
That's
going to be one of those. Okay.
That's kind of fun. I love that. But what are some of the other episodes that might be coming up in the season?
Right. Yeah. There's the other reporters are hard at work investigating a few different leads. One question that we got was about it's a real, you know, good Juneau political history question. Why is Juneau the state capital? So, you know, that's a can of worms, but Clarice is looking into that one.
Fun one.
Alex, our environmental reporter, Alex Solomon, is looking into a question about where Juneau's eagles go at certain times of year. You'll notice that there are more eagles and less eagles. So where, what are their, do they have a migratory pattern or are they just here all the time?
Okay.
Jamie Deep is looking into a question we got about a supposed Awooga button downtown. If you're familiar with the Awooga button, Jamie would love to hear about it. I had no idea we had apparently just a button downtown that goes Awooga.
Well, you can push it and it'll say Awooga?
Yep, that's what Kevin Gullifson wrote in to tell us about. So that's what we'll be looking into. And then there are definitely some other questions we'll get to. There are some that we've been looking into over the years that we haven't quite been able to flesh out a full story. And one of those is about Stephen Richards Memorial Drive out in the valley and what the origin of that name is. And we've gotten as far as to find out that there's a sad story associated with it about a young man who died in a plane crash. That was Stephen Richards, and that it was named in honor of him. But we have been unable to track down sort of more of that story. So if anybody is familiar with Stephen Richards or his family or just sort of what the conversation in the community was like around that time to rename that street in his honor, we would love to hear about it. Yvonne Crumry would love to hear about it. So feel free to reach out.
Yeah, and you can reach all the reporters at the contact page on KTOO. You can send in specific things. Also, you can go to kto.org/CuriousJuno. You could submit your own question or follow up if there's something you know about. But you can also go to the kto.org/contact, and there's a way to reach each reporter on there. You can fill out information on the form. And you can get that message to them. So that's really helpful. That's really cool that there's going to be this cool season coming, 2025. And one more time, give us the details about the event happening on this Friday.
Yeah, Friday, 8 a.m., coffee with K2. Stop by and have some coffee and treats and maybe some North Douglas cake. And you can help us decide on what the last episode of the season is going to be by helping us vote on a few of the questions that we've received. And you can, like Boston said, submit your question.
Yeah, absolutely. That is so cool. Well, thank you so much, Adeline, for hanging out with me, listening to some of these cool episodes. It was like we were binging.
Yeah.
It was like we were binging.
It was a nice tour of people of some of the past alumni of KTOO as well. And I really enjoy hearing all their voices from over the years.
Yeah, it's really fun. So you can go back and listen to this episode again. You can find out all the episodes of Curious Juno by subscribing to the podcast. Or you can also visit the website kto.org/CuriousJuno. Thank you so much for joining me, Adeline. Today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Gonna cheese. We're gonna go out with a little bit more of the theme song from Curious Juno. That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. Unless we do a special Tuesday episode like we did today, which was so fun. You can find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback, suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Our theme music, our normal theme music, is by Indian Agent, but today it's by Simon Matheson. Thank you so much, Simon. Really appreciate that song. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Adeline Baxter. Gunath Cheesh. Have a wonderful Juno evening.